You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and the other fellow on the screen. Some people say we look like we could be related, and we're wearing the same colors. And that is Chris Thinnes. Had I had a bio, I would say something from it. But Chris, I know Chris as an educator for many years. And you started most of your work at elementary school?
Yeah, the overwhelming majority of it in elementary schools and some of it in middle school as well.
Right. And mostly at independent schools, private schools?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, in terms of consulting and board work and things like that, I've worked with a lot of public school districts and organizations, but all of my leadership positions have actually been in independent schools.
Right. And so we're going to, I hope this doesn't get so geeky, but we're gonna talk about a few things, sort of topics that seem juicy and ripe and timely and important to us. But first of all, let's get this piece out of the way. I mean, I don't know this about you. I don't know if you're a public school kid. Like, when you were growing up, where'd you go to school?
No, man, I am a product of independent schools here in LA. So I went to a couple of different independent schools here in LA, both for elementary and then for middle and high school. And had a very complicated relationship to schooling as a student, as so many folks, including you, I suspect, had, and in some ways was driven to come back into schools exactly because of those experiences, get back in and mitigate some part of that experience for others.
Okay, so let's just clear this piece up. So, private schools, I'm a public school kid, right? I grew up going to public school. There was a different time. Language was different. It was on the East Coast, so who knows, there's plenty of private schools there, but I didn't really know about them. And I knew they existed, but I wasn't really sure why. And, people didn't ask, do you go to private school? Do you go to public school? Do you go It's like, you go to school, which one?
Yeah.
That one down the block. Everybody goes to that one. And I think I probably felt like private schools must have been some sort of elitist, I didn't know that word, thing. But how do you ever run into that? What's the whole deal with private schools anyway? Why do we need them? What's wrong with the public schools? Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, in terms of my own experience and my own perspective as an adult, my own experience as a student was just, I was socialized in a family where that was just what you did if you could for your kid to get the best education. And as a child growing up and having that experience, but having no other benchmark of experience except the experiences of my friends, maybe from the neighborhood, I had nothing to compare it to. And so, I think what my parents believed as two folks who did not grow up in the privilege that I did, but found their way through their careers in a way that they were successful for a significant period of time during my childhood, they felt like they were doing the best thing in the world that they possibly could for me, and that I would have opportunities of some kind to learn really deeply, that there was a cultural currency in terms of placement into college, et cetera. And all these ideas were completely unexamined, either for me or by me, until I was a little bit older still. And, a lot of baggage came with that, which I only really started to unwind in college and grad school when I came to realize the limitations of the private school experience for me in terms of living in the world and for the world. and also learn so much more about the ways the public education had been framed and so on. So a lot of my professional work has been around as much learning myself about how to navigate the different, you know, sectors, but as well how to ask some critical questions about the institution of the private school, you know, to your overwhelming question, why? And, you know, I mean, I think there's some answers as to why they were born, and I think there's some answers as to why they still exist. And I think most of those are rooted, you know, in racism and classism. I mean, I think the burgeoning of the private school in the United States was primarily, not by any means exclusively, was primarily as a response to the movement towards desegregation and, you know, in the 20th century. And it's, that, you know, that's a fact I don't think can be overlooked.
Yeah. Do you, when you look back or when you, wherever you look for it, do you regret going? Do you wish you had gone to public school?
You know, when my son, who's in his mid-20s now, was in elementary school, he went to the private elementary school where I worked. And part of the reason for that was, you know, we had a tuition remission, like we'd get time in the car. It made sense at the time.
Sure. And
after that experience, my wife and I started asking the question, and so did he. Like, I visited all these astounding, transformative public schools in these different cities. I live in a major city, Los Angeles, and I wondered, like, where is that public school that's got some kind of innovative approach to deeper learning and also a commitment to social justice here in LA? And so, you know, long story shorter is that my son went to a public high school. And I say all of that to get to your question about my own relationship to my own experience in private school, which is one day after all those years in private school, about a month into his experience of a public high school, we were at a red light and we're both facing forward. And I was like, well, you know, how's it going? I mean, you're navigating a much bigger school, a completely different demographic. And, you know, how are you doing? And he just paused for a second and he said, you know, Dad, I feel like I'm finally going to school in the world. and like, I tell that story about him because vicariously, I had that suspicion that he might have that experience. And he expressed that with a sense of relief that he was very much aware of the bubble in which he was functioning in the private schools. He was very much aware, especially through his friendship circle in music and other activities outside of school, that his friends were having a different experience entirely, that there were differences of identity and perspective, you know, in every corner of his life, except in school, which was well insulated by, you know, any number of privileges and entitlements, to the point that, you know, he felt liberated by going to public school and feeling like he was among, you know, he was among humanity as it actually exists. And, you know, to that extent, I regret that regret may even be too strong a word. Like, I kind of wish I'd had the experience myself. And to whatever degree that I've been able to do some good work in related areas over time, I'm glad I had the personal experience of being a private school student to ask some critical questions about it with some credibility.
Did you ever have the feeling like you wanted to teach at a public school?
I did. I wondered when I first made that move from, you know, doing research towards my doctorate at UCLA into a classroom. I just threw out applications wherever I was because I needed a job like right now. And drifted into that position where I knew that I would be welcome as a former student. I've thought about that, and I've really enjoyed, as recently as last week, like consulting work and collaborating with folks in the public sector. So I've always thought about it. I have not done it, and that I do regret. I do regret that I haven't worked in a public school.
Yeah. You know a little bit of this story. It's like the first private school I had anything to do with was as a teacher. When I got hired came to Los Angeles And I was one of those, you know, I'm going to take the first job that comes along. And I put my resume everywhere. And it never occurred to me to do it to private school. But a friend of mine knew the head of Crossroads School and gave him my resume. And so I got a call and I got like an offer. And I was like, okay, it's a job, you know. And it was so different from my own experience in school, of school, that and fun. I mean, it was super. Crossroads was, at least at the time, I don't know what it's like now. It was a festive environment, and it was definitely looser and more sort of celebrated. The learning could be a good thing, you know. You didn't have to feel stressed to be in school and learn. You could enjoy yourself while you were at school. That was seemed to be the attitude. And so it felt great. And I came to, over the years, I came to think it's like, and I don't know if this is true, that you know, when I would go to visit public schools, which I did periodically, you know, that was a really different scene. It was 35, 45 kids in a class. Not everybody was uniformly enthusiastic about being in a school, being in class, doing work, all that sort of stuff. And I came to think of, well, geez, a private school might be a good thing if it could be an experimental place, a place where you can, you develop certain sorts of things that could then be visited out to the rest of education, right? And if it plays that role, and I don't know if it does. I mean, so I ultimately, you know, at least at that place, I came to think, geez, this may not be the place I should stay, because it may be just for that thin slice of the world who, you know, everybody should be able to enjoy this and they can't. So shouldn't I go work at those places where there are more of those kids who will never see that? So I've come out to this weird, I have a weird relationship with the whole private school world, having spent most of my working career in a private school. You know, and so, but I have mixed feelings about the whole thing.
Oh, so what you've just said brings up so much. I mean, like, first of all, I have all those mixed feelings. I don't necessarily have regret about childhood experience I had, because that's all I have.
That was your experience, yeah.
And throughout my working life in schools and throughout my like graduate education, I have very much felt at odds with the ethos of the place in a lot of ways, even as I intentionally have positioned myself at certain times, almost like, you know, like the progressive mole, you know, where like maybe, and this was one of the reasons I went back, is like maybe in some small, maybe even oblique way, by showing up in private schools to be of service in a different way. And by a different way, I mean, by trying to mitigate some of those self same things that cause that profound discomfort at times, maybe it could make a difference in the private school experience, you know, for others folks. And I think what you're pointing at is like the core question, which when you ask, why do these, like, what are they for? And yeah, in so many cases, they feel like they've got a different culture of learning than some, definitely not all, public schools. And I think it all gets back to like, you know, what's the public purpose of private education? You know, the ages old question. You know, you reminded me of like when Al Shanker first pitched the idea of the charter school, right? Like sometime in the 80s and before he bailed out, like he said, like, given all of these restricted policies, starting in the late 80s, moving obviously through, you know, the beginning of the 21st century, that were impelling public schools to have a different vibe, as it were, gathering all teaching and learning as a sub-function of performance on achievement tests, you know, pretending to eliminate achievement, all of the everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, those were structural things. Those were not decisions that public schools made to approach education a particular way. They were necessary enactments of public policy. Whereas private schools were liberated entirely from those structural forces that impelled a certain kind of learning and made it possible for that Crossroads experience to take place. Like Crossroads didn't have to do any number of things. And I guess, you know, Shanker's question when he proposed originally the idea of the charter school was, given how, you know, handcuffed public school educators are to explore innovative, transformative methods of teaching and learning, what if we had this other kind of public institution where the educators were entitled to make significant decisions about new approaches and then were obligated to report back to us in the broader community of public schools about what was possible?
Right.
You know, the idea ended up being obviously transformed and transmuted, and Shanker bailed out when it became what it became, which is a way to, in some cases, to privatize public education. But that core idea always seemed attached to the notion of the private school. If you are going to siphon funds out of public funding that could go to public education by making these nonprofit institutions, if you're going to be free of restrictive state or federal education policy that gives you the opportunity to design curriculum and pedagogy the way that you want, what does society get from your entitlement to these liberties?
Right.
And over time, but for fits and starts in certain corners in the private school world, like the answer has been like, well, not much.
Not a lot.
Yeah, it's like actually nothing, if that's okay. But for some brave examples, yours having been, you know, at least two of them. Tsunami of words, but like a really vexing question.
Yeah, I mean, I've met so many people, I'm sure you have as well, so many people who are just so enthusiastic about private schools with almost no consciousness that there's a lot of people who can't do that. There's just a lot of people who are not going to be able to do that. So what do they get, or what can be offered there? Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it doesn't, you know, none of these issues necessarily, just thinking logically, necessarily imply that the experiments that private schools have been able to perform and the discoveries that they've been able to make are irrelevant to teaching and learning in public schools.
Right.
I think the issue is like there's no, there's rarely a felt obligation to offer what was discovered back to those schools. And for that and many other reasons, a lot of transformative teaching models remain primarily the province of really well-funded suburban districts and private schools.
Right.
And, for shining examples in several cities.
Well, it's interesting that there also is, we've both known some great public school teachers and there's stuff that goes on in private schools where classes are really small and teachers have the freedom and the resources to do all sorts of things. And in many cases, it's really hard to bring that back to a public school environment where suddenly there are 40 kids in a room and all those things about, you know, teaching in the public schools that discipline is different and the motivations are different and the pressures to, you know, to get three kids through the system is different. And so it's people are not thinking about, well, geez, how could this be, how could we use this and embed it in a, what your son's version of it, and like in the real world.
Yeah.
And it's a hard one. And when it happens, it just seems so dazzling, right? You know, some phenomenal teacher figures out, I can do this with 35 kids in my room. I can watch.
But for the exceptional individual who's able somehow to figure out how to work the system in that direction,
absolutely,
there's very little change, structurally that encourages that kind of stuff. And like, not to derail, but I feel like the converse or the inverse or whatever the right verse word is and I hesitate to name this because my intention is not to drag private schools, like, far from it, but there are also a lot of independent schools, great reputations, great placement records. And on any given Tuesday, you might walk into a room and see some kind of like patchouli oil drum circle nonsense going on in which the teaching and learning is not particularly cognitively complex. There aren't particularly challenging expectations being offered to any of the students. And yes, everybody might be quite comfortable and seem pleased to be there,
but
that's so often mistaken for engagement and deep learning in independent schools. Like, there's a lot of reasons why children get placed into their top choice of college, and not all of them are because they're gifted creatively, intellectually, etc. I think in the independent school sector we tend to overlook that simply because we're independent schools does not mean that we're offering a transformative experience.
Right. Well, yeah. I do wonder, do you think it's the patchouli oil that adds to the value of that experience? I mean, would other oils work just as well?
Peppermint is delightful as well. We used to use those in diffusers in one of the school to settle the children. Yes. So I have experience in this. I'm not kidding. And listen, like, I'm not, my intention is also not to drag any particular kind of oil, because like a little patchouli oil at the end of a long day, like, who doesn't? But anyway, we're on the same page. And, it just makes me wonder, what drives this in a different direction? What impels independent schools to have a sense of public purpose? What other than independent schools wishing in some cases to have a public purpose entitles independent schools to decide what they have to offer to the public sector? Does the public sector care?
You used the language before, right? You said you talked about deep learning, right? Like, that was a goal of, and not necessarily something you get in every place. But what do you mean by that? And why is it of value? I mean, I know I'm asking a question that you think I know the answer to, but
I feel like deeper learning has become sort of an umbrella for a pedagogy that privileges more than one domain of children's development. That it's not exclusively, first of all, it's not exclusively intellectual, but it's also in terms of healthy emotional development, development of a sense of social consciousness, the capacity not just individually to achieve in a particular area, but collaboratively to communicate across difference and to construct something that's bigger than the parts of individuals. And I also see deeper learning as a reaction against the sort of late 20th, early 21st century policy enforced pedagogy in public schools that determined that, our latest version of intelligence tests were adequate to define the value of children. And so I think deeper learning tends to empower the voice and agency of the student, not necessarily to decide what they're going to learn, but to ensure that what they learn is connected meaningfully to their sense of self and purpose. That deeper learning is extremely cognitively challenging and honors the process of critical thinking and problem solving over the result in terms of the artifact. And, you know, and I think a lot of other, you know, little geeky things about teacher learning, but see it as something that independent schools have been far freer than public schools to pilot, experiment, discover, learn, exactly because of the pace of policy requirements in public schools and exactly because of the freedom independent schools have from it.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, the resources.
It's so interesting. As you were talking, it was like, I flashed to, I don't remember. It was a documentary. It played on regular network TV a billion years ago. I forget when. And it was about great schools. And it showcased a handful of schools, maybe three, maybe four. And there was one scene, and this was all being shown as an example of like, these are the schools, right? These are the schools you want your children to be at. They were all public schools, and but it could have been anything. And it showed, there was a moment in one of the schools where they were filming it, where it was a U.S. history class or something like that. And the teacher had the creative idea of breaking it up into two teams. And, you know, this one, and it's like Jeopardy, you know, and like who gets the question first or who gets the answer first or whatever. And I'll never forget it. It was somewhere, it was deep in the game. They were getting really close. And the teacher said from his podium, standing in front of the room, the teacher said, in what year, and this was U.S. history, and it was, you know, it was like the forming of the nation or something, and in what year, and this kid on the team just screamed out, like, you know, whatever it was, you know, 1783, and the teacher said, that is absolutely correct, and the kid celebrated, his whole team celebrated, they had won. There was no question, but he got the right answer. And that was just like, that's what people are responding to.
That's
like,
greatness, yeah.
What we want is not, we want not that.
Yeah.
We want that. Because now everybody on that team, especially that kid, thinks that they had just achieved something that's just like, yes. We won, and like, that is a great class. Whoa, my God! And he was the smartest kid at that moment in time, and it was like you're sitting there going, like, "Wow, that's amazing!" And that is like the worst version in my world of that's conventional education. It's like it's just about the right answer. It doesn't even matter if you've asked the question, as long as somebody got it.
And oh my God, that's so wonderful at so many levels, including but not limited to what a great example of mistaking excitement for engagement, of, you know, correctness for an epiphany.
He studied really hard, and so he got that answer.
Yeah, totally. No, I want to, you know, like, listen, what I want to see, and not that I want a particularly moody school, right? I don't, you know, nobody wants to, like, a moody vibe, but. But like, I, on the contrary, I would be tempted to think something is a great school if I saw evidence that children in the room are appropriately uncomfortable because of the complexity of what they're being asked to do together. And second, that they're comfortable in that discomfort exactly because they feel seen and known and valued and know that this is the space where they can stretch themselves and not have to win the game and not have to be right and not get to be the winner, but be engaged with each other in building something bigger than they know they are themselves at that moment and wanting to do that. Like that, that's a kind of greatness that you can't see in a single example, but, you know, but like that's what's always blown me away is when kids take healthy risks, concede their failures, and look to each other
right,
you know, to trust each other through that process. Right. That's the mark of a great school.
Yeah, you just reminded me of actually, there's just another, and we're going to move on from this in a second. I don't want to beat into the ground, but I was, you know, when I was running New Roads, you know, I did MBWA, management by walking around. You know, how do you know how things are going? Well, you know, you go see how things are going. And I walked into this one English class, and it's just this wonderful teacher somehow. You know, it wasn't the particular structure of this event, but it was so clear to see that how this event ended up going was because this teacher had managed to create an environment that encouraged, just, they were regular kids. It wasn't some sort of an honors class or anything like that. They encouraged these kids to like dive deeply into what was going on. What was going on was that, I forget what the book was. They had read a book, and you know, in all sorts of ways, the setup was so banal. Right? They'd read a book, and you know, they'd done whatever chapters, and with those chapters, it was, you know, it was a ninth grade English class, and you know, here they have vocabulary words from these three chapters. So they went home with a list of that and whatever, and I walked into, they were all sitting around, so they could see each other, and the setup was, we're going to talk about the book. And in every one of your sentences, it has to be a real conversation about the book and about what went on. But in every one of your sentences, you have to include one of the vocabulary words. And it's like, okay. And so, you know, the bolder kids sort of dove in first, and then the teacher didn't call on them. They made sure that one another participated. So, you know, they call their friend or they call the kid who hadn't been, you know, participated yet and whatever. And then one girl, never forget it, one girl, you know, participated, you know, extended the conversation. And it really was a conversation about not just what happened in the book, but the feelings of the characters and how this was different or the same as what they had done before. And she included two vocabulary words, and she had to use them correctly. And she did. And that was like the little nugget. And she just, it was like she turned up the amplitude just slightly. And then the next person was gonna do at least two. And then the next person, three. And then, and they suddenly, the whole room was, ooh, what was like a symphony of, oh, it was, you took the most boring thing about an English class, vocabulary. It just turned into this symphony of like festive, and they really were using the words, and they were really, you could see them, you could practically hear their brains gurgling, working to be able to come up with the next thing to say. It was just spectacular. It was spectacular.
Magic. You already busted out the word symphony. I was, as you were speaking, I was like, this is, you're describing jazz, you know?
It's just this amazing, 100%. Beautiful.
Yeah. So, and imagine, you know, I mean, one can already imagine what had happened before that day to create a classroom culture that didn't just invite or allow or tolerate that kind of improvisation, really. But also welcomed and encouraged it and saw that as the demonstration of rich engagement. It's amazing.
Yeah, exactly. And it was the contrast between that and in what year? 1789. What?
Yeah. It's just amazing. The other piece of that story that you tell is like, you know, you know, you remind me in telling the story, like this started off as you got a vocabulary list yesterday and you got to become familiar with the words and it's, you know, and like, none of that is particularly transformative. It's how it was leveraged for the group to work together. And it just, you know, over the years, maybe you've had the same experience too. Like I get really hunkered down in a particular adherence to a pedagogy. Like if you don't do it this way, you're not doing it the right way. And there's a right way to do project-based learning. There's a right way to have a progressive, you know, all those things. And
It's never that.
No. And in part, like this book by Jalmeida that I've been reading recently, like called attention to it. And I've had, you know, analogous, but not nearly as brilliant as his thoughts about it since. But, you know, at the end of the day, if you're not also learning what works from other models and fusing them together in the toolkit and aren't so like didactic or precious about a singular method.
Right.
Like that's what's, you know, so, you know, whatever the vocabulary, but let's do that.
My response to that is, you know, we both worked in progressive, theoretically, in a progressive environment and progressive education. And it so often was the stalest progressive environment. And because the focus was on the form so much so, I mean, like rigidly this form, you know, in a group, you have to have four members and there's a note taker and there's a person who moves the conversation for. And I was like, oh my God, just shoot me. It just, I don't feel any better about this than I do. The guy was just standing. I mean, and I've seen some of the best classes, the just best in that same way that that everything came alive for those kids in the material and in their thought. And there was a guy in the front of the room talking. That was it. I mean, he didn't have any, you know, there was no fancy, there was no props, there was no. So you know, it can happen in so many different ways.
When the protocol for that transformative, progressive, facilitated dialogue itself starts to feel like a worksheet, right?
Yeah, exactly.
100%.
Exactly. Okay, so I'm just randomly changing the subject because it's my show, whatever. But this is not what you're doing right now. You are not currently working at a school, but you are working in the world of education, and you mentioned before consulting, and would you talk some about the kind of the consulting stuff that you've been doing? And I know you just came back from the mind bending experience in Texas, and so could you talk a little bit about that whole world and why you're doing it and why it matters?
Yeah, after my last leadership position, like it was really clear to me that. You know, my heart is in the deeper learning and my heart is in equity and justice, in as ironic as possible a space being the independent school environment. And I always felt in my leadership roles in schools, like helping to advance the school's strategic goals for equity and justice was some part of my job, but I felt like I always had to sneak it in or position myself to subvert something that was taking place or think really tactically about how to, you know, affect change. And one of the things I wanted to do is have the experience of doing like DEI forward work in schools where I didn't have to like conceal or sneak in that part of myself. And so it led to a variety of different contexts in which I've been doing like DEI consultation with schools and districts.
To what end? To teachers, to administrators, to kids, like work in
many of the above. So part of it has been helping other folks who are conducting equity audits in some schools and districts where something more elaborate and goal driven than a kind of culture and climate assessment in order to be able to provide strategic consultation to school leadership or district leadership about ways to map a strategic plan for equity and justice into the trajectory of their organization. Foundational stuff, some more advanced stuff, depending on the case. Some of it is involved leadership coaching, working individually or with a leadership team to help consult with them on their own personal as well as collective leadership work in the areas of DEI. So it's been sort of a grab bag of all of the above. This most recent experience that you talked about in Texas, there was a district in Texas where the leadership team, a small district, and the leadership team is committed to doing equity and justice work in order to meet the needs of a profoundly ethno-racially diverse student population. And they're situated in a state where much of that work is forbidden by law from taking place, you know, where there's words you can't use in these schools. There's conversations you can't have. And there's things that you can't fund, period, full stop. And so, you know, the reason for taking collaborating with the folks in the district to do some of this work was exactly, well, how do you do that? How do you advance your equity and justice goals and better serve the needs of minoritized subgroups of students in a state where you can't really have that conversation? How do you build a common vocabulary amongst people who are forbidden from using the words? And it was a vexing challenge, and I hope we did some good work. But the idea was, again, to get back to, you know, the marker of transformative education being a fundamentally deeper kind of learning, and mapping that explicitly to the sense of belonging that's cultivated in the students, that you cannot, by any number of measures, by a giant pile of research, by the results of the PISA test during every administration of that test, from all available sources of actual data, students learn more deeply when they perceive a sense of belonging, when they feel a sense of safety, both physically and in terms of being treated fairly and with respect, a sense of connection to other folks at the school, adults and students, as well as a connection to what the institution stands for, and a belief that if they're not already doing it, that they would feel comfortable and able to contribute to the collective goals of the institution. Like if students feel all of those things, they are almost invariably going to learn more deeply than their peers who don't.
Right. And is a genuine question.
Yeah.
Is DEI work, diversity, equity, inclusion work in schools, is it somehow closely related to social emotional learning or not necessarily?
I mean, my personal opinion is it's a yes and, which is recklessly generalizing. It's my opinion that good DEI work informs and helps to shape the healthy emotional development of children, and sometimes approaches to social emotional learning on its own tend to perpetuate some of the problems, particularly with ethno-racial equity and justice, which is to say, there are schools that have social emotional learning programs that feature dimensions of learning like how to control your emotions and how to persist regardless of adversity. And the implicit message is that by controlling one's emotions and persisting despite adversity, you'll do better. But it also implies that if you're not doing well, that you are therefore unable to control your emotions and don't know how to persist despite adversity. And I think it's right there that the real problematic messages start, unless there's a mindfulness about the similar and separate goals of both of those fields of work.
So this is genuinely a question, even though you might think I have a clear answer. But I why does it matter? Why is it that work is important? Why, you know, you feel called to do that,
yeah,
that work.
Yeah.
Why?
Wow.
Why both? Why, maybe it's why you.
Yeah.
Or maybe it's why in education. Well, in education, well, because we know somehow there's a relationship between that work and better achievement, whatever the fuck that means, right? Whatever school's for. But that's, you know, that's the least interesting answer in some ways, right? You know, and it's the answer that they want to know. Like, yeah, if you can show me that this is going to improve test scores, I'm doing it, right? But why? Why does it matter? Because it's mattered to you in your work life
yeah.
for years.
Yeah.
Maybe forever. But yeah. So why?
I mean, wow. Thank you for asking the question. It's such a simple question. And, you know, just as you said, you might be asking a question where I might think you have the right answer. Here's an answer where I still have only questions, which is, I think the root of it was feeling personally impelled by inequities I witnessed and participated in as an independent school student, and then into my early career as an educator working in them, of really explicit ways in which bias and discrimination and systemic configurations like impelled different levels of performance among students in schools, from, you know, things we've all seen and known for a long time and somehow found a way to, you know, not respond as though it's emergency, such as the inequitable outcomes and performance on standardized tests across racial and ethnic subgroups over the decades, and the introduction, you know, of No Child Left Behind, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to resolve those things, which in the first 15 years only exacerbated them.
Right.
So feeling personally impelled to kind of go back in and maybe change some nature of that experience. And then the other, I don't know if this is too sweeping, but is seeing over time, you know, that the history of American education and the history of segregation are inextricably intertwined, and that the state of American education doesn't feel to me like one in which we have this unfortunate situation where, despite a system that presumably works, increasingly the majority of public school students are ill-served, but actually a system that requires that to be true and ensures that remains true, and has done successfully so for quite a few years now. So I just, for me, both personally and professionally, it's a matter of trying to reconcile reconcile inequities on the personal level and inequities on the structural level that are so overwhelming in their scope and impact that I feel kind of morally impelled to do what little I can without pretending a greater authority than I have.
The questions, it's not really questions. There's sort of pronouncements that it's bullshit from the places, you know, from Florida, from Texas, from, like, you know, the places around the country where it's, where, Don't give me that woke, language, that DEI stuff. Well, you know, whether it's happening in the schools or it's happening in businesses or whatever. And there's always an effort to link it to, well, you know, the point of school is not people's feelings. The point of school is to, you know, for people to learn better. So you have to link it to some sort of a reliable measure of achievement or success educationally. And in business, it's, you know, well, sure, but it's got to contribute to shareholder value or the success of the business, or because otherwise, you know, it's not our job to just, like, and I think the only answer I ever come up with for that, may just be because I'm not imaginative, is that, well, yeah, that's, as long as you define it that way, that it's not our job, because our job is only to make sure that kid gets the right answer and make sure that those people's stock goes up. If that's it, then so it really is. So why do I think it's so important? Well, because it's morally important. It's like, it's been so shitty for groups of people for such a long time. It's like, well, I mean, if nothing else, it's just, okay, well, let's just switch places for a little while. Just, you know, just that. But it is, I mean, it does come down to, because it feels like a moral imperative, right? Like
100%. 100%. So. And, you know, if one is as acutely concerned about, you know, the state of democracy as one is about the state of education, imagine is somehow separate from that, then you know, then I feel like that moral imperative is extended to a kind of service generationally to children who are going to have to inhabit this world all of us and our predecessors have created, and in which they're going to have to make decisions and thrive. And, you know, if thriving in a pluralistic, multicultural democracy is at least ostensibly a goal of the American experience, it seems important that that children become fluent and skilled at doing that, and that requires an extension of a definition of the purpose of education well beyond reading, writing, and arithmetic. It just does.
Right, exactly, exactly.
And yet, you know, to say that is obviously taken by so many folks as itself a political argument.
And well, it's like, you know, tossing raw meat into the lion's cage.
100%, 100%. And you know, and that's, you know, just for me, like an intriguing part of like, how does one situate oneself in that whole conversation? And it doesn't feel political as I'm thinking about it or talking about it with you. It feels like, you know, I was educated to believe certain things about, you know, the aspirations of the country in which I grew up. And it seems kind of consistent with service to what previous generations shared with me about what it is we were all trying to do here.
Yeah.
I don't think belonging is a political issue. I think belonging is something that everybody, like a desire to feel a sense of belonging, is something to which I think everybody can relate. And the idea that even the effort to restore a sense of belonging to folks who've been made not to belong, that the idea that that's somehow excluding, you know, two white men in conversation about American education. Like I carry a big bag of privilege that makes me quite comfortable walking into lots of spaces, whether I do or don't belong. Anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm going to do something that just seems criminal at the moment, which is to actually say thank you. And at least for this iteration, pause this education, this conversation, and say thank you for being willing to have it and spend so far 54 minutes and 57 seconds having a conversation with me.
David, so it's a joy to connect with you. So, at all times, and I want to say it again without, you know, seeming maudlin or disingenuous. Like, thank you for your example of all that you've brought to this. Like, you know, I've always considered you a friend, mentor, shaper, etc. And you're one of the great examples of what's possible in this world of education to me.
So, thanks, dude. Appreciate that.
Yeah,
it means a lot.
Yeah.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.